Okay. And I thought there were going to be a lot of people who saw my talk last year, Cold Spring Harbor, which there are only like two. But I, so it's a totally different talk. So we'll not, and Vijay warned me that, there's going to be a lot of interruptions, and that's great because I totally ad-lib every talk and I have no idea what I'm going to say yet. And so I'm probably not going to get to the computation stuff. I want to tell you about my some of the newer stuff we've been doing. But it's motivated by the computational stuff that we were doing with considering the role of quantum synaptic failures and energy efficiency of computation. And when I say computation, I just mean a dendrite adding up its inputs. That's all the computation I'm talking about. But that's the critical computation of the brain. I mean, of the elements of the brain. So I guess it's sort of a position I'll take. Many parametric observations in nature can be made sensible when interpreted from the perspective of energy efficiency. And a lot of the talk will be, what do I mean sensible? Some of us have incorporated this energy efficient perspective into an information theoretic perspective, specifically neuronal coding and neuronal computation interpreted from the perspective of energy efficiency makes sense out of the low firing rates and the high synaptic failure rates observed in cortical forebrain systems. So that's what I'm probably not going to end up talking about, but essentially I'll give you the motivation for what got me to the talk that I'm going to give today. And this is the beginning of the revisionistic textbook history today, okay? Because we're going to now start from the bottom and go up, but that's not really how it happened. We sort of jumped into the middle and then sank down. So there was this idea that was christened InfoMax by Linsker. And the idea was really more or less invented by Horace Barlow 21 years before Linsker christened it. And the conjecture was to consider neural computation going on in this box here, and that something came in. Are we okay?
I would like to change something here, if you don't mind.
Okay. We're still okay? Yeah. All right. Okay, some signals come in over a long history of time, probably, and some signals go out. And the measure that Barlow proposed for sensory process, for processing in sensory systems, early processing in sensory systems, was, well, let's see how much information gets through. And Shannon would write his mutual information like that. I'm not going to bother to write the formula, but that's mutual information. And at the same time, you know, well, we want this to be large, so Linsker would say max, and of course x goes to x. Well, gee, I maxed it, no problem. But they say no, there's more to the game than that. We'd like to alter the statistical dependencies of this vector input. Okay, so this x is x1, x2, x 10 to the 6th. Let's say we're talking about the fovea of the human eye. Small number, right? So we're interested in the statistical dependence, and the measure that Barlow proposed was an extension of Shannon's pairwise measure, and Watanabe actually proposed it first. But it's essentially another relative entropy divergence, I don't care what you call it, of the joint distribution divided by the product of the marginal distributions of all these guys. And you want, and in the InfoMax idea, you want this to be as small as possible. You want this to be statistically independent. So this goes to zero when the joint distribution is exactly recreated by the marginals. In fact, that's actually a bad idea for neural computation, but we won't talk about that. You shouldn't go that far. But Barlow said, well, you should surely reduce it. And he has alluded to things about saving energy and stuff like that. So this is what got us into the game. And I was sort of playing this game and trying to understand how small bits of nervous system would developmentally wire themselves up via synaptogenesis and help with the Infomax problem. And as we were doing this stuff, you know, I said to my friend, colleague, Rob Baxter, I said, you know, this is all pretty much nonsense. These numbers are way, way wrong that we're talking about here. If we really wanted, you know, if we're really going for, the, you know, if you look at the how much neurons fire in the brain versus what you would really want to do if Infomax were the game that nature was playing, neurons would be firing at 100, 200 hertz, because their maximum frequency is 400 hertz, and the best way to use things is if you use them half, if they send ones half the time, zeros half the time, so they should be going up 200 hertz. But in fact, we knew that the firing rates in the hippocampus, and particularly, is very low there, 1 hertz, 5 hertz, something like that, maybe lower. And in neocortex, depending on the species, we'll talk numbers like 5 hertz, 10 hertz. Certain motor areas will be average firings of 20 hertz or something like that. But the numbers are over an order of magnitude off than what the Infomax theory was suggesting. And so that's, you know, to me, that's motivation. Well, I can do better in an order of magnitude off, so I'll take a shot at this. And so we did the Levy-Baxter 96 optimization, where we showed if you found out how much energy it costs to fire an action potential versus not fire an action potential, why do you care about what it costs not to fire an action potential? I mean, Barlow missed that entirely. Because you're sending zeros, and zeros have information. Even though you send tons of zeros, you think, oh, another zero, who cares? They're still not probability one, so they still carry information. So that optimization only works when you take into account there's information in both ones and zeros, and there's a charge for both ones and zeros. Why is there a charge for a zero? Because there's passive leak to maintain the equilibrium of the ion potential, of the resting potential. Okay, and so you get a curve that can be optimized, and it optimizes in the right range, and it doesn't change too much whether you use a pure 0-1 binary code, a rate code, or even now we've played around with some interpulse interval codes, which are very, well, you can get any result you want because no one knows the proper noise levels to limit interpulse interval codes. So here we go with the revisionist history. So we got that to work. The reason we were able to do that, and the reason that was actually a nice piece of work, was, of course, it optimized, but the numbers existed in the literature for what the cost in terms of ATP, right? That's, so we'll say, if you're a physicist, you think joules, but if you're a biologist, you think adenosine triphosphate, okay? Because that's the currency for energy in the brain, right? So glucose and oxygen come together and do a whole bunch of things with NADs and things like that, and all of a sudden you can regenerate ADP into ATP, and that's where the energy goes, and then it's the ATP that keeps the nerve working. It runs the sodium potassium pump. Okay, and that's the name of the game, and it's probably even more fundamental. It is more fundamental than what we'll be talking about. So. We had those numbers. Those numbers, by the way, are like in sciatic nerve, they're like 60 to 1 or something like that. So it's 60 times more expensive to fire an action potential over a minimum computational interval, which if you look in neocortex, it's about 2.5 milliseconds. It's 60 times more expensive to fire and recover from an action potential. It's the recovery comes after the action potential is fired, but you're paying for the action potential. 60 times more expensive than just to sit there for that same period of time and send a zero. Okay. So now here's the revisionist history. Why is an action potential so damn expensive? And thank God for Simon. And Atwell and Laughlin published an article, which, you know, I don't know, my studies, the study section that reviewed my grants told me not to do, and it looked like it was too hard to do, and they came up with some very tricky ways of solving certain costs of working out the entire energetic budget of the brain. Particularly clever is the transmitter part of the story, I think. And it turns out that if 85% of brain energy goes to computation and communication, it's ballpark, then almost half of that 85% going to computation and communication, almost half, I think the 47% is the number in the article, goes to the action potential, not to computation. It goes to communication. Communication is much, much more expensive than computation, where computation is adding up stuff on the dendrite. Okay? So the action potential is the burden. And we're talking about the unmyelinated axons of NeuroPil, which are probably, they're not regular axons, right? They go for a while and they bulge out because they're making synapses, and they go and they bulge out. And so they're probably particularly expensive axons. So all of a sudden the Levy-Baxter thing was like, hey, we lucked out. We worked on something that is really important to nature. Okay, so now I don't feel bad about this. I usually feel bad about talking philosophy. I love talking philosophy to mathematicians. They start to fall asleep. But how is it? What's the big program here, and what's going on? Because we'll get to the action potential. So the first person who considered biological constraints was a physicist. Well, he was really a mathematician, to tell you the truth. He had a PhD in math and had a job in a math department for a while. But you guys claim as a physicist. And he pointed out that you just couldn't scale animals in an arbitrary way. And he said, well, let's look at bones and let's see how big can we make an animal that builds bone, that has bones like your femur or something like that. Okay, and he pointed out how fat it had to get just to make it a little longer. Okay, and he said, look, there's really a limit on what can be done. Now, He didn't have the advantage of natural selection as an idea kicking around in those days, and would have gotten himself probably poisoned if he had even brought that up. So everyone knows who it is, right? It's Galileo. So, but we have the advantage of having natural selection. But let's, before we talk about natural selection, I don't know, so people might want to add stuff to this list. Here's my list of the constraints of computation and communication. And you might as well just say to yourself, or you can say to your 12-year-old kid, what do you want in a portable computer? Well, you want it to be fast, you want it to be small, you want the battery to last a long time, you want it to compute a lot, you want it to be light, and hopefully it has to be buildable. we don't think about that too much. Nature worries about it. Engineers worry about it. And we'll see in the action potential, well, we already got motivated by this whole thing by information required. So we're optimizing, so the Levy-Baxter result was optimizing information and information energy relationship. And what we're going to concentrate on when we talk about the action potential is time. And you'll see Space Occupied shows up when we're doing this. Mass doesn't, I don't know that mass ever really comes up. Well, yeah, mass might come up. Mass and buildability, might explain some why certain axons are or are not myelinated. But we probably won't have time to. Those are just fun speculations. Okay, now we're going to head towards a little Darwin stuff. So we have this whole list of things to worry about, but why are we going to, why should one even, you know, naturally go towards energy efficiency? And all those topics are legitimate topics and need to be researched and will be touched on. But why go to energy efficiency? So here's a little history of the Earth. So there were things, there were living things around, make up a number, 3.5 billion years ago, something like that. I don't know what the real number is. Maybe it's 3.7 these days or something like that. Long time. Okay, long time ago. When did animals show up? Well, the current numbers, I'll show you a slide that just came out in Science a couple months ago. About 3/4 billion years ago. It took a long, long time for animals to show up. Why did it take so long for animals to show up? There was no oxygen on Earth. There was no free oxygen on Earth. So there's a big argument about 2 billion years ago as to whether the oxygen content of the atmosphere was 10⁻⁴ or 10⁵. That's the argument that's going on. Okay. I don't know what it was a billion years ago, but I would guess it's surely going to be less than 1%. And then between a billion years ago and 600, and so between a billion years ago and 3/4 billion years ago, or something like that, we had something called snowball Earth. What was the problem with snowball Earth and animals? If the animals are going to evolve out of the sea, there's a little problem. There were glaciers down to the equator. That means there were glaciers everywhere. So there wasn't all that much oxygen going to be showing up in the water either. Okay? So when you talk about energy, we usually, as biologists, we usually think about glucose and stuff like that. You think, oh, you got to eat to get energy. Of course, a human would dehydrate before they would starve. So water must be more important. But what's more important than water? Well, air, right? How long can you hold your breath? Okay, so this is a really big deal to animals, oxygen. And the point of this is the more efficient you are in every kind of way with the way you handle oxygen, the better you could have evolved sooner. You can evolve at the margins, and that's how evolution takes place, at the margins, that animals that move deeper in the water, go to colder places, go to warmer places. Actually, warmer places have lower oxygen, so it's harder to live there. Animals that start to head towards rivers where there's less salt, animals that start to come out of rivers where there's lots of no salt. These are tough problems that require the solution to those problems are energy. Well, I'm going to get a really good kidney, and I'm going to pump like crazy to make the inside of my body suitable, even though the outside is really terrible. So energy is a big, big deal, and it is sort of rate limiting. You can imagine, at least, and this is just so stark, that it is rate limiting in speciation, certainly a long time ago.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It seems like the argument you're making is that the animals that we see today are, of course, we're all aerobic. Right? On the other hand, you have this several billion year period in which you have microorganisms, many of which are anaerobic.
Right.
Now, do you actually want to claim that aerobic metabolism is essential for the emergence of multicellularity? I mean, where's the break? Once you're down a particular line, I think the argument about energy efficiency are fine, but I actually don't know why it turns out. I mean, is there a reason why microorganisms are kind of distributed, aerobic, anaerobic? I don't even know that there's a majority.
I can tell one other just-so story. I obviously can't tell the say the answer to your thing, but I can tell one other just so story. So there is one. I know there are probably a handful, but I can tell you one enzyme, one protein, that is really discerning about whether you're an animal or not. And every cell, and with one exception that I know about, and it's a wonderful exception, every cell in an animal's body has this protein, and every animal's got this protein. And that protein is sodium potassium ATPase. And if you're not an animal, you don't got it. And even in the breakdown, is not, if I had said metazoan, I'd be wrong. Sponges don't got it, I don't think. But jellyfish and stuff like that have sodium potassium ATPase. And every cell has sodium potassium ATPase. So, and that bugger uses a lot of energy. And I guess the other aspect is that, and I don't know, you know, again, this is not my area of expertise. These are just those stories. But all animals are essentially parasites. And our closest relatives are fungi, which are parasites. And we're glorified fungi from the point of view of evolution. And to take advantage of all the good stuff that plant life does takes oxygen to release that energy. So that's my final just so story. And when you can get your hands on that oxygen, then you can do crazy things with your cells so long as you have sodium potassium ATPase. And there's an alternative theory of sodium potassium ATPase that has nothing, it's in the literature, has nothing to do with the nervous system. It has to do with maintaining ionic gradients and osmotic gradients that would normally explode a cell. So just having the generic class of cells that all animals have apparently requires sodium potassium ATPase, and it is a energy hog in general. So that's the story. I don't think I can do better than that, Bill. But I will show the evolution picture, the close one. So, okay. So we're going to argue that microscopically, at least, neural communication and computation are energy efficient. Microscopically, I mean at the cell level, synapse level, axon level. And don't anyone ever think that I made this mistake. Natural selection is an optimizing process, but organisms are not optimal. And the reason that guys like Gould hated this optimizing argument, because people would use the optimizing argument for the evolution of religion and language and stuff like that, and they considered that pretty flaky. Whether I don't, you know, it's sort of fun. That's a Gould. I think he was trying to deny other people having fun, but down microscopically, it's a damn good argument, and if bits and pieces of organisms, you know, bits and pieces of organisms might be near optimal, and if something has not changed for a long, long time, and has been present in many, many species where there are many, many opportunities to change. And as a matter of fact, we can even find other versions of it I'm being very general here. Let's do the example. The action potential hasn't changed for 550 million years, and that's the action potential that's used to send information at high rates. Okay, there are some non-action potential kinds of communication and things that Simon and I were talking about, but like nematodes and stuff like that do things. But that's a different kind of story. But if you really want to send information at high rates, this thing has been stable over a long, long time. And here's the picture. This came out in Science this summer, I guess. Oh, sorry, PNAS. And these numbers, I don't know if people generally believe them, but they've pushed things a whole lot more recent than I used to think of it. So the sponges, right here, 653 million years ago. And here we're showing a split between jellyfish kind of things and us at 615 million years ago. And then sometime before the so-called in the Precambrian, all of a sudden a lot of things happened, and in the Burgess Shales, which is the Precambrian, you can see all these kinds of animals. Hemichordata, that's us.
Can you lower the...
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, there you go. Okay. It's nothing. Okay, starfish, certain kinds of worms. This is the squid's relatives. I think nematodes are in this one. I'm not sure what else is in them. I forget what that is, or maybe that's nematodes. I don't remember. All kinds of bugs. All right, so somewhere around here, by this estimate, we're not to the action potential yet, but because who's got action potentials? I don't know if starfish is. These guys have action potentials. The question is, do they have sodium-based action potentials? So that's currently being argued. Almost with one exception, they're all calcium-based action potentials. But we know that there's good action potentials here. Cockroaches have good action potentials. Squids have good action potentials. Segmented worms have good action potentials. You and I have good action potentials. So the sodium channel has been around for a long time. But all this did hinge on the sodium-potassium ATPase being around. But the point is, things have been stable for a long, long time. And, okay, so now let's think about action potentials. I think there's a theorem, I'm going to have to look it up sometime, saying that in electrical engineering, that on-off keying is maximally energy efficient way of communicating. Well, we know that nature agrees with engineers that when we want to send information over long distances, Morse code for starters, I don't know, I guess smoke signals for starters, maybe. So I have no idea how they do more smoke signals. But when we send things over long distances electrically, anyway, we use on-off keying. And we find that nature agrees with what engineers do. They use zeros and ones.
How about acoustic communications?
Acoustic communications. Well, you should actually say, how about the internet? How about the Ethernet? Because the Ethernet.
So I think what nature is most in the Ethernet.
Huh?
What is the nature?
So nature uses codes without delays, more or less. If you start requesting what Shannon was most interested in is error correcting codes, what a lot of his work was important to him back then. And you had delays with a lot of error correcting codes, and there's a lot of good ways of coding pulses, even sending something like a sync function or something like that, that you need to use delays because you need to go to infinity in both directions, so in time. But for just straight signaling, you do want to use on-off. I think there are some theorems about energy efficiency of on-off coding. I told Simon I was going to mention this. Simon, is what's his name? Aldo's name?
Faisal.
And is he a postdoc or graduate student?
He's a graduate student.
So. Okay. So those guys had an article that came out at one of the WCNN neural network conferences, and they showed that Simon and I talked about this beforehand, that nerves have to be incredibly small before signal to noise ratio becomes an issue in signaling. Oops, sorry. And I read that, and I had just probably a couple of years before had read Nahan's book on Heaviside, Genius in Solitude, and sort of skimmed through the Maxwellians, and I was very much reminded of the major argument that Heaviside had with the engineers in the British Post Office who ran the telegraph. Who ran the transatlantic cable. Of course, then, as now, they wanted to send more bits per second through the cable. The cable was damn slow. They said, God, we can't get any more information through the cable. What should we do? And Heaviside modified Thompson's equations, and that's Heaviside's modification. He added the inductor, and he told everybody what to do, and certain everybody's didn't believe him, and they said, no, 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 you're wrong, and I'll explain to you what Heaviside's point is in terms of signal theory in just a second. They said, it's a signal-to-noise problem. They didn't use those terms in those days, but they said, it's a signal-to-noise problem, and I'm going to prove it to you because I'm a practical engineer. I'm going to increase the signal, and I'm going to increase the way I transmit in the transatlantic cable. I'm going to send a lot more information, okay? So the result of increasing the signal of the transatlantic cable not only did not increase the signaling rate of the transatlantic cable, it broke the cable. They had to go out somewhere near Greenland, I suppose, and fish it up. And of course, they had the technology to fish it up because that was all part of the cable technology. That's pretty cool. Heaviside was right. So what's the problem? Now we're going to see that Heaviside was very, very much concerned with bits per second, but he didn't talk that way. What Heaviside did, and you guys know better than I, except I know that all you young people have Jackson, and everybody who has Jackson has no memory of understanding that the wave equations that they read about are totally relevant to the transatlantic cable and explain the dispersion in the transatlantic cable, and that was the problem. Heaviside understood that if in New York you're doing on-off keying, when you get to wherever in Scotland the receiving station was, the signal doesn't look, the signal's not a pulse anymore. It spreads out. It spreads out much worse than I'm showing you here. It spreads out terribly, terribly a lot. Why is it spreading out? Because the cable is dispersive, because of the capacitance of the cable, because the phase velocities of this signal, which has all frequencies present, the phase velocities of the different frequencies travel at different speeds. And so the high frequencies are running ahead of the low frequencies. And so the pulses interfere with each other. So we have what today is called inter-symbol interference. And that was why the bit rate was low in the cable. And Heaviside understood that very well. And I have to say, mirror string galvanometers or whatever they had sitting at their receiving stations must be incredible instruments and must have been perfectly frequency matched to do what they had to do and stuff like that. Because it didn't matter how small, they had no problem detecting the peaks of those guys with the string mirror galvanometers. The problem was, the pulses were running into each other. Okay, and Heaviside understood that. And so Heaviside invented what today we call the matched filter. And let's see if I have everything here. So, there's the equations that Heaviside figured out how to solve for the for his more complicated cable that included inductance, and he realized that that he could offset the bad effects of capacitance with the right amount, with the same amount of inductance. And I don't see my slide showing that, but essentially that's what the matched filter is. And so now it's fun to say, here it is. Right, so here's the velocity. It's frequency dependent, but you can get the frequency term to come out and cancel if you can have L equal to C, it turns out. Okay, so all the phases that exist are now traveling at the same speed. And, you know, we're sort of comparing, well, what would an engineer do and what would nature do? And I said, oh, yeah, on-off keying. Nature likes it. Engineers like it for long-distance signaling. Well, then why not use Heaviside's solution to increase the bit rates of axons? Why not use Heaviside's solution? I mean, by the way, when you play this game with nature, you shouldn't say, gee, your nerves weigh a lot because you got a lot of iron in them, or maybe samarium, or whatever kind of inductor you're going to use to create the inductance, okay? But that turns out not to be the issue. It just dead wouldn't work to use the Heaviside solution. And the reason it wouldn't work is the speed of the action potential would be, without putting too fine a point on it, like 100 times slower for the same size axon. If all you did was create the match filter, you would get rid of so many high frequencies, and you would be so dominated by low frequencies that things would travel very, very, very slow. And here's an engineering, I don't know, if, I wouldn't call it a textbook, it's probably some kind of Bible back then, 1927. And these are numbers you're always looking for, I finally found. Here's how fast electricity goes in a wire. 174, people always said it, people always told me it was near the speed of light, but never told me how fast it was. Okay, 174,000 miles per second at 800 hertz in this kind of wire. And then a heavily loaded, I guess M might be mu metal or something, whatever it was in 1927 in England or something. 10,000, so it's like 20 times slower when you use the Heaviside solution to the problem, when you puconize it, I guess some people would say in America. The Heaviside solution was known to slow things down. It wasn't such a bad problem in those days, though he does complain about it here. But it would be a disastrous solution. It would be a disastrous solution for nature to do that with axons. And why? Because the capacitance is so incredibly high in axons. That's where the cost is coming, and that's where the cost is going to come from. Why is the capacitance so incredibly high in axons, in unmyelinated axons? Because capacitance is inversely proportional to how close things are together, right? You get your plates really close together, then capacitance goes up. Okay. Well, how far apart are the plates of membranes? 5 nanometers. Right? 40 angstroms, 50 angstroms, whatever you want to say. Okay? It's like that. Okay? The things are really narrow, and that's what's creating this terrible, terrible capacitance in unmyelinated nerves. We see that nature figures out the solution of separating things a little further with myelin. But there are certain things nature can't, so in this evolutionary argument, there are certain things that nature can't go back on. So you can't change hundreds of reactions to just make one thing work good. So you couldn't just say, well, we'll start building, I'm sorry to personalize nature like this. I really, you don't have to think I really think this. Let's make plasma membranes thicker. Well, think how many reactions that would screw up. I mean, you're shuttling all the good stuff in and trying to get the bad stuff out, and it would be much, much harder, and the proteins have to be just the right shape, the ones that are going all the way across the membrane and stuff like that. So this is a real showstopper to say I want wider plasma membranes, okay? But that's what you need to have less capacitance. You can't really change the constituencies that won't even change the capacitance much if you change the carbons. So we're stuck with this sky-high capacitance, and we're stuck with the fact that we can't use inductance because nerves will still be too slow. And of course, we now nominate the natural solution. And so here's somebody's textbook picture where instead of having inductance in this cable, we now have variable resistance, the sodium channel. And so we're essentially trading energy. An energy solution for an inductive solution, and what we're trying to create is you guys know about this stuff, supposedly, probably. We're trying to create a traveling, however you want to spell it, wave. Why do we want to create traveling waves? Well, by definition, traveling waves don't interfere with, there's no inter-symbol interference in traveling waves. Why is there no intercept? By definition. If you have successfully created traveling waves where you can have multiple traveling waves going down, so not just a single traveling wave, but if you can have multiple traveling waves going down a wire and they're still just the same traveling waves, then they're not interfering with each other. How do I know they're not interfering with each other? Because by definition, a traveling wave stays the same shape wherever it is. Okay, and so long as they're staying the same shape, They're not interfering with each other. So the solution that nature came upon was to create a traveling wave, and it used energy to compensate for the capacitance to create these traveling waves, and of course...
That's only in the linear system.
Which what?
That traveling waves do not change shape.
Well, these are all nonlinear systems in order to make them, but linear systems. I don't know how to answer your question. We could probably talk about it. You probably know more about traveling waves than I do.
No, I don't. Okay. It's just that I know.
They're very hard. Let's just say, we'll talk. It's very hard to write an equation that makes a traveling wave if you just sat down with a piece of paper and pencil and said, I wanted a traveling wave. And you would, you know, and it was a big deal when Fisher and Kolmogorov and his colleagues were able to write down a traveling wave. That was a pretty big deal. And to say some of the minimum requirements of certain polynomials in there to create a traveling wave.
And then you're creating solitons.
Yeah, you're speaking of solitons.
So solitons would not be energy dependent, is my understanding. Or solitons can pass through each other, so an action potential by definition fails the... So you have to make a special definition of soliton. So yeah, so soliton is a traveling wave, but it doesn't. But a nerve action potential is not a soliton by the pass-through def requirement.
Yeah. I guess I'm having a related problem. So I could take the complement of ion channel and tune their densities so that although it requires energy to do it, I compensate the capacitance. And I can even imagine making an almost dispersionless transmission line in this way. Right? I start with a capacitance and some stray resistance, some stray conductance, and I now start putting in all these channels that have active elements that and if I let them operate in their linear range, they are equivalent circuit elements that can compensate the resistance.
Right.
Can null it,
right,
get the impedance
right,
almost flat if I
right,
can
right,
right.
An active dendrite.
Right.
So,
and you know, we
right,
certainly know about cells that do some of this.
Right.
Now this isn't a great solution because it's not very robust, but
right. So,
it's
so in fact, I did so in the Fisher traveling wave, and in the Kolmogorov, whoever PP the other, and his colleagues are traveling wave. The interesting result is that they show that you always end up with something of this form in a traveling wave. That there is a polynomial requirement here. So linear. So this term has to be nonlinear. That's a proof. And I can't remember if it's second order or third order.
Well, but
it's required. It cannot be a traveling wave.
It's required to generate a certain set of things, but
no. If you want the wavefront to be constant, it's required that this be nonlinear. This term right here.
I guess what I'm asking is why I can't use ion channels operating in their linear range to create something like what you refer to as Heaviside solution. I mean, you don't have literal inductances. So there's one transition, which is that instead of having real inductances,
okay, right,
you have the circuit equivalent of inductances, which depend on energy.
So,
that's obviously a very
okay,
important transition.
Okay.
So you could just stop there, right?
So to maintain velocity, you have to maintain shape and height. That's an absolute requirement.
But that's a statement about the dispersion properties of the transmission line, right? I could tune.
You can't. I don't think you could. My understanding, and maybe you know, it'd be good to go over this, and for you to plant the right questions in my head to look at the literature, and see what it is in the derivation. But my understanding is that if you want the thing to work in the way you're saying, and that is, and velocity is the issue, right? It's not only do we want to detect these things, but we don't want them to show up too slow. We don't want them to show up too late, because information. So, word from our sponsor. Let's talk about information. Information must be timely. We all agree on that. Do we care that much about yesterday's weather forecast today? Do we want a stock tip on yesterday's market? Right? Information must be timely. In order to, so therefore, you've got to get that thing moving down the axon. And just to prevent inter-symbol interference is not enough. So velocity is an issue to maintain the timeliness of information. So what I want to do is that, and if you're interested in both the shape and the speed, then I'm pretty sure a linearity won't do it, because you have to maintain the exact shape and height to maintain the speed, and that requires nonlinearity. So, okay, just for fun, I'll talk about stuff at the edge of my knowledge, so maybe I'll learn some things. So what we're going to talk about is, again, we're headed towards optimization, maybe. I guess, velocity per energy. So we're headed towards some kind of optimization like that. I don't know. It's like meters per second, and it's joules per meter. Joules per meter traveled, and then there's a little iffy term. I'm not entirely happy with this argument, but you might also be concerned with the volume that's occupied by the whole deal. So that's meters cubed per meter traveled. And you get something like that to optimize, maybe. inverse seconds. Well, inverse seconds doesn't feel good. Let's call it timeliness. So what we're optimizing, and you know, so this is a little flaky, the timing, the energy expended to get things to show up at the right time, and that's what we're going to look at now, in some of our work, and we're going to go back to Hodgkin's idea that the capacitance of the sodium channel will limit the action potential that can be constructed. Okay, so why is that? In order for a sodium channel to work, it must detect changes in voltages across the membrane. How does a sodium channel detect voltages across the membrane? Well, it has these charges sticking out. The people talk about paddles, so here's a paddle. It's got a charge on it, and that this paddle can sort of wiggle around across in the direction of towards the inside or towards the outside of the membrane as a function of course, some Brownian motion, but as a function of the voltage gradient across the membrane. And when the membrane becomes depolarized, these paddles move with in the appropriate direction given their charge and the gradient. And that somehow changes the configuration of this membrane-spanning protein, and then sodium ions are selectively allowed, more or less selectively allowed, to go across this essentially ohmic pathway across the membrane. Okay. But the capacitance we said was, remember I said, oh yeah, okay, there's this charge. Sorry, there's this charge paddle thing moving. Well, that's acting like a capacitor, right? It's a funny kind of capacitor. Once you push it here, it can't go any further. Can't go any further. So it's a capacitance that gets used up. Hodgkin understood the capacitance had to be present, right? It's a great Nobel Prize. They predicted there were going to be gating charges that could be measured, and they eventually were. And Hodgkin said, well, look, this is a problem. We know if we had more sodium channels, we could get the action potential to go faster down the axon, because we'd have a bigger spike. And a bigger spike would, you know, you can look at the equations and say, oh, yeah, that would go faster. So maybe there's an optimization, this is Hodgkin, maybe there's an optimization where the channel density is restricted because of the capacitance being added. As you increase the number of channels, the capacitance being added to the membrane is defeating your whole purpose of adding more channels, which is more velocity, because capacitance goes against velocity. Right? Sucks off all the high frequency stuff and velocities in your higher frequencies. Okay. So that was the idea that that Hodgkin propounded, and it sat there for a while, 25 years. And then we started playing with it. And the first time we played, well, this is what we published, and we mentioned another solution in the paper where things are even a little more accurate. Like, but our point is this, that the axon, if you just have this naive idea, well, the squid axon's for escape, it should be very fast, is the axon optimized for channel density? That's what Hodgkin was talking about. And essentially, in Hodgkin's model, you'd actually go to a twofold higher channel density than is actually seen, but it's not, you'd say, well, it's not much difference. But in fact, if you use the modern serial model of the activation of the sodium channel, I'll show you that in a second, the channel density is like 4 or 5-fold higher to optimize velocity. And the reason I want to show you this serial model is it just shows how clever nature is. So the serial model, you know, there's lots of versions of these, and you know, you can look in Patluck's review article in 1991 and find, I don't know, like 14 versions of these, but they're all essentially like this. You go close, different, you know, different conformations, close, open, inactive, and recycles or something like that. Okay, but the point is, to go through these successive closed states requires the voltage sensors to do their thing. And so there's charge movement, capacitive-like charge movement that gets used up, funny kind of capacitor, that gets used up as the sodium channel is sensing these things. And that's so much more clever than Hodgkin's parallel model of channels. Because nature even has figured out how to hide a lot of its charges. So here's my, don't take this picture too seriously, okay? There's a lot of biophysical molecular biology missing from it. But it shows the idea, okay? That you might have, so there's only one, the net charge of these things are all one, minus one, and let's say swinging this a charge on a pendulum is somehow connected to the protein and goes helps you go from C1 to C0 to C1 C2 to open. And the point is this, that you can hide the capacitance. You don't have to have all those charges sticking out, as is the case in Hodgkin Huxley the M cubed model, where he says, okay, all the charges are there. There's three of them, and they're all going to move across the membrane. In fact, modern measurements, and I didn't make this up. I mean, I made up the picture, but I didn't make up the idea that the charges are sort of hidden, because the modern measurements, which have studied the C0 to C1, C2, C3, C4, associates a small charge movement with each of those states. And in fact, the number they give for the total charge movement is like 6. But you only pick up 3. You know, if you were doing the whole measurement, you get Hodgkin's 3. But in fact, the number is 6. And this number is important for creating nonlinearity in the sodium channel without interfering too much with the channel. And so here's what's happening during the action potential. I know it's probably more than you want to know. To the charges. So the textbook capacitance of I'll say 1.01 microfarads per square centimeter includes the capacitance of the sodium channel. And so people who've gone in and measured the sodium channel, and Hodgkin and Adrian and Huxley, they all knew, I mean, if you go in, you look at what they used, I mean, they knew that. They said that. And then so they said, okay, the membrane is 0.88, and then the, you know, it's about 0.13 that is that belongs to the sodium channel of the capacitance. And they did some rough calculations and stuff, and that's how they came up with this theory, but they were very rough calculations of the theory that the sodium channel would be limiting by virtue of its added capacitance. But here we see taking Hodgkin's M cubed model, the capacitance. So we're watching the action potential go by. Here's the action potential. We're watching the action potential goes by. Here it is, the depolarization. And here you can see the sodium channel capacitance getting used up. And remarkably, it's almost all used up well before the peak slope, the maximum slope of the action potential, when about 30% of the channels are open, which is right here, which is about right here. The charge is almost all used up. And if you have this concept of these hidden charges, you get much the same answer. It gets used up a little faster. Okay. So that was our analysis of the fact that the axon wasn't optimized for velocity. And then we said, well, what's the charge or what's the relative charge? And so we're this is in picomoles for ATP, and we can argue about whether this is an exact result or a proportional result. It's not worth it. The point is the shape of the curves. Velocity costs energy, and it doesn't matter whether you use bigger diameters or you use stronger batteries or you increase channel density. But increasing channel density, things get worse very fast, and this doesn't even, is really a bad solution. And so now you can say, well, how about something like this, velocity per joules? And you start to see things like this. And this is, again, calculated from the wave front, is the sodium flux in the wave front. And you can't optimize diameter. Wow, that's bothersome, isn't it? Maybe not. And I'll talk about that in just a second. And battery strength says, well, we could use this, well, I'll explain how that works in a second. Channel density looks pretty good for where it is. Battery looks like it should be a little smaller. And
so what is one?
One is the biological value. So that's variance from the biological value.
What's the biological value?
For each of the parameters. So for Hodgkin-Huxley squid axon.
So one
for channel density is the 128 millisiemens per square centimeter of sodium channel. And diameter is for Hodgkin's reported axon of 476 microns. That's one. And for battery strength, that's all the Nernst batteries are taken as their value as one. And so when we vary battery strength, we vary all the batteries so that the resting potential stays the same. So it's very hard. So it's very hard to value timeliness. I don't know how to do that. Okay, that's why I'm a little iffy about writing that down, among other reasons. But it's something like that. So why not say, okay, nature knows what it's doing. It's got to. Let's just plot things isovelocity. Let's take what the squid is, and let's vary these parameters pairwise so the velocity stays the way nature wants it, the way it evolved. Okay. And again, we're using the serial model. I'm sorry, we're using the parallel model, not the serial model. So this result will come out a little different. Things are pretty good, but it looks like, aha, you say, if you change diameter and battery, so that would be smaller diameter, bigger battery, you can beat nature at velocity per joules. So now we have to scratch our head because we never can beat nature. We're never allowed to beat nature. It means we're stupid. It means we're not clever enough. So how is it? What might be limiting the situation with the battery. Now, it turns out, okay, and now we go back to the sodium potassium ATPase. One of the ways, and there's several places to go with this battery story, but why not have bigger batteries? Why not have bigger batteries, right? Smaller diameters, bigger batteries. Well, I can tell you one reason why with minimal change you can't have bigger batteries. You can always come up with an argument, well, nature could do da, 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 da. But what does it mean to have a bigger battery? It means the gradients have to be bigger, right? So sodium is, I'll give you the MAMO values. So if sodium outside is like 140 and sodium inside is like 8, and potassium outside is like 2.6, and potassium inside is like 130 or something like that. What you want to do is drive potassium outside down below 3 and drive up, you know, drive it up inside. Of course, you can't drive up the inside too high because that screws up the osmolarity and the isotonicity, or certainly the osmolarity, right? I mean, we need the gradients, right? Nernst potentials are log of the gradients. So we need to change these gradients a lot to make the battery like this. But it turns out, I mean, so there's all kinds of reasons why you can see, geez, it would be terrible and almost essentially impossible to have these bigger gradients that this kind of optimization is suggesting. But apparently, and finally, it's some recent data showing a pretty good calculation on the energy use, the energy efficiency of the sodium potassium ATPase. And there's an article, it's only a couple years old. I mean, if you look at textbooks calculations, you'll find bounding computations on the efficiency of the sodium potassium pump, and the bounding computations say, you've got like 55 kcals per mole of energy available from splitting of ATP, and the pump is using at least 40, 45 of those. In fact, recent calculations shows that almost all of the ATP free energy is converted into, is equal to the free energy of the pump for pumping sodium. So essentially, you'd have to say, I need a whole new pump. I need a pump that uses 2 ATPs instead of 1. Okay, or I need to boost the system. Like, so we have another system that can be boosted. So the calcium gradient is sky high, and that's boosted by the very expensive mechanism of using, was it? It's 4 sodiums to 1 calcium or something like that. So you use a very, very expensive boosting pump to get those sky high gradients. So one of the limitations seems to be the sodium potassium ATPase on making a more efficient action potential. And there are other limitations which we hopefully can get to. So I guess I should summarize this section to say that that axons are incredibly expensive in order to maintain velocity because of the energy that is used to produce velocity. That is to say that the sodium ions flowing in, which have to be pumped back out, and to go any further with a lot of this stuff requires thinking about how the actual sodium channel is built and what's buildable in terms of sodium channels, which, since we don't actually know enough about the sodium channels, is pretty speculative kinds of things. So, DJ, what should I do about time? What do you want?
So the next, Simon is going to get his Blackboard talk at 12:15.
At 12:15.
So people usually go and get lunch from lunch trucks close by before you have lunch. So your goal is to stop at noon.
My goal is to stop at noon. Okay. So I'm at a natural breaking point here, and otherwise I would show the Levy-Baxter results or some quantum failure results or something like that. Do people have questions here? Because we make it easier, and you can have a long lunch break. And
where are you sitting? You can always go to my office.
Yeah. So yeah, so what I'm not showing is how we optimized and I said this in the introduction, how we optimized the signaling rate, the p being the probability of a neuron firing or not firing, and how that was a function of both the energy consumption when you're sending zeros versus the energy consumption when you're sending ones, and then that was ratioed with the information capacity and didn't matter that much. Oh, I remember what was the thing I said I would come back to? Now I can't remember. We had an infinitely efficient axon. Right? Remember if we kept decreasing diameter, the efficiency is going to go to infinity more or less for all. Okay. So am I bothered? Are you bothered? So electrical engineers have encountered such a situation. So the cheap form of signaling, which was of concern for satellites that are low on energy, that are, you know, have to get all their energy usually from the sun, was to use interpulse interval coding, right, to measure the time elapsed between the ones that are sent, and so all the different code words would be the different intervals depending on your resolution of being able to discern how long it whether it was one more tick of the clock that it had elapsed since the signal, the original, the last one, and so if you think about that kind of coding in a naive way, the way engineers thought of it, you can do the calculation and you can show that you can have infinitely cheap communication. You can have communication that costs nothing, but the rate of communication is zero. And the point is this: if you allow the time between pulses to go to infinity, you have an infinite number of code words. So information capacity is going to go to infinity. Unfortunately, you have to wait very, very long times to get each word, each letter of the alphabet. Okay? There are other costs that would stop you from going that far, but that's why this is sort of silly. This is defeating the whole timeliness issue. Yeah.
There's another reason, which is if you make it small enough, then the noise in the ion channels will start creating.
Right. Well, that's yeah. Right. Right.
Get, right?
Right, right. So that's Simon's.
You can do the whole calculation starting from just asking about information rather than the energy, and you get very similar answers in terms of very close to the natural density.
So, well, according to my calculations, we're way, way, way above. The signal noise ratio is incredibly high in the squid axon. The squid axon has so many channels. That the noise levels must be incredibly low. But I agree, when you get down to small axons, the argument would...
Well, it's actually since the number of channels that you need to create an action potential, to start the action potential, is much lower than the density, and the effect of that is going to be lower than
that. At the generation point.
Yeah.
At the generation point, okay. So we're okay. Yeah. Yeah. I would like to see that for the generation point. Yeah. So this is the this is to maintain conduction. So that was the one thing. So we cleared that up, and So I don't know. Why don't I end here? And if people want to talk about quantum failure stuff, which we are continuing to do, I'd be loved to talk to people about that. Thanks. Thanks for your attention.
Question specifically about the principles that you were talking about,
okay.
But it's very much related.
Okay.
In molecular and cellular biology, right now, there's a lot of concern about problem of control of the precision and the control of gene expression and whether cellular mechanisms are robust to large, relatively large fluctuations in the numbers of different protein molecules.
Right.
Now, if I take lots of squid giant axons, how constant are the channel densities? I mean, if it actually matters what the channel density is, which is the heart of the argument, okay? We could people could have different ideas about what it is that's being optimized, but presumably the end result is going to be that I care that the channel density is X and not X plus 15% and not X minus 20%.
Yeah. So I guess the honest answer for the squid is, okay. So if you do the measurement in terms of conductance per square centimeter, because there are serious problems in counting, I get the impression that I should go through, and we need a good comparative study, I agree, that it is relatively constant. There's no question. The question I'm more interested in is when you go across axon types, unmyelinated axon types, that's a tougher question. How constant is it? And it would seem that the position I should, the argument that I should take is that it depends on what we want is a constant shape and height across species, across whatever variable, and that there is something very good about the shape and the height for the wave front. But that'll, of course, hinge upon arguments about how fast you need the information to show up. So I have to, in asking that question, if I were to look at pain fibers, which have a slightly different action potential, have a slightly different sodium channel than other axons, these guys conduct pretty slow. And so we would have to take the argument that we would have to say, well, maybe, you know, I get to weasel out of things by saying, well, for some reason, pain information doesn't have to show up very fast. Apparently it's the case. And you get to nature gets to use a slightly different sodium channel. So, but the variability in the sodium channel, rather than its density, I mean, we can talk much more. There's been much more research in the molecular variability of the sodium channel, and it is pretty tightly confined, even across species, is my understanding. They get very excited when they find a variant of the sodium channel. So I guess that's the answer. But I agree that those are the kinds of things you have to look at. You have to say, well, how, if something's important, how constant is it? And it's even a greater test of the theory to go across types of nerves and species and stuff like that. But I agree. It's a good question. So yeah.
So at least computationally, people have simulated axons. You can get 10-20% difference in ion channel density, and it doesn't make much of a difference.
Right. So, yeah. Well, you saw some of our curves were pretty damn flat, where we were saying they were optimized at certain places. So I guess that means I can weasel out of things because we can allow a little more variability. Nature's very thrifty, though. It even cares about 10-20%. So, yeah, great. Okay, so I'll be here all week.
Thanks, people. Yeah. Thank you.